This is The Producers, a podcast. The biggest names in audio production, station sound, radio imaging, branding, and voiceover. Interviews, tips, tricks, advice. To be a part of the show, visit RyanOnTheRadio.com. Now, The Producers with Ryan Drean.
Hey, Producers Podcast time. Yes, the podcast for producers and also voiceover artists. And this one will be very much towards the voiceover talent. If you aspire to work in or have anything to do with the industry of voice, then this interview will have some value to you. If you are a radio imaging producer and don't give a crap about voiceover, I'm going to be honest, don't waste your time. This will be a waste of 67 minutes or whatever this, 70 minutes, whatever this came out to be. So I will say, I haven't mentioned it in a long time, but Ann DeWig helped me out with some voice for the intro of this thing a long, long time ago. That was her. She comes up again. She's come up in a lot of different episodes because she's awesome. Everybody loves her. But FYI, for those that didn't know, that's actually Ann DeWig's voice in my intro. She'll come up with Brian Cooney. Brian is a great voice talent. I am actually was a big fan of him on the commercial side of things and TV promo work. I know I knew a lot of his work from there as well. But he's a radio imaging guy too. Voices lots of stations and in fact was requested for this podcast more than two times. I don't remember exactly how many times, but he got onto my list a while back. I think he is one of the voices for DC 101. We go over that in the interview. Anyway, but I really enjoy his style in the world of commercial voiceover. So you'll hear a little bit. I'll play a short sample. I'll throw together some promo work, commercial work, and radio imaging work real fast here. We'll go into that. I don't know if I already said this, but I have not much more to say in this intro, so we're going to dive right in. I'll wrap up with any notes at the end of part two, as I always do. The only note I have, I got ahead of myself a little bit. The only note I have is to say before Christmas, before the holiday season really takes my life away from me, I am going to have a quick chat with Joe Cipriano. I don't know how long I will have to honestly spend on it. In other words, I might just get him on, interview him, and just put it out. I might not spend any time editing or putting any fanciness into it. But I do want to get that out before Christmas comes around because he has a new book. It's a great gift idea. And I love Sip. I've known him a long time. And so this is just a great opportunity for me to have a quick interview with him. And we'll be doing that very soon because I'm putting this out Monday the 16th. So anyway, the point is that's the only thing I can really promote in the immediate future for this podcast. And then I got tons of big people to talk to as we get into 2014. But that'll all be coming up next month. So anyway, if you don't hear from me again, have a great holiday season. Obviously, be very safe in your travels. If you do get to go somewhere, sometimes it's not get to go somewhere. Maybe it's have to go somewhere. If you get to stay home and do nothing, well, good for you. I'm happy for you. And but anyway, have a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a great new year. And now, some demo work from Brian Cooney. You will know who this guy is if you didn't know who this guy is, believe me. And then the interview comes in two parts. Here's Brian.
The smartphone with everything you need and the one thing you want. Xperia Play, coming soon from Sony Ericsson. New telescopic explosion mascara from L'Oreal. Get a dramatic effect with our breakthrough spherical brush. It applies like no big straight brush can. American Restoration is working on its biggest project yet. On August 5th, Friday's number one show is moving to a new time.
WRKZ Pittsburgh. This is where Pittsburgh rocks. 93.7 K-Rock.
AM 640 Toronto Radio.
KRKA.
E-Rap.
Lafayette.
Hot.
107.9.
AM 860 KPAM.
The talk station.
At Q94.5.
We want to be your station.
Come on, how about $20? And a beer? All right, I'll pay for the lap dance. That's cool.
All right, and we kick off another episode, another great guest, and this guest, highly requested, multiple-time requested guest, Brian Cooney. Brian, thanks, man, for being on here.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. Who are these people?
These people are, I would say, mostly radio imaging producer types.
Okay.
I can think of at least two that stand out. One referenced your work at DC 101. Yeah. Are you still the imaging voice of DC 101?
I am, yeah. I think Drew Patterson, we share that. So I know I'm still on.
You are one of the voices.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long have you been a voice on DC 101?
That's a good question. Probably somewhere around 3 to 4 years, maybe somewhere around there.
Okay.
I don't really keep track of it, to be honest with you. Like, for example, somebody I just signed with recently, and I was like, and my agent pointed out that, that it's been like 8 years or whatever. And I was like, oh, we've been with them that long. I'm like, oh, well, okay.
I've talked to many voice talents, and a lot of them echo the same thing, especially when it comes to auditions. But, you know, you kind of get things, or especially you audition for things, and you sort of just put it out of your mind. Is that kind of how you work? You do the job and then move on to the next thing? You don't hold on to things? You don't hold on to work or gigs, as it were?
That's pretty much accurate. I have gotten to the point now where... When I do something, it's not only auditions, but sometimes jobs. It'll get to the point where I'll do something and it's out of my mind as soon as I'm done with it, especially auditions, because my view on that is, and it takes a while, like anything in this business or any business for that matter, it takes a number of a bit of experience before you before that dawns on you. And basically what it is, if you walked out of every audition that you did and kept wondering, well, God, I wonder if I was good, maybe I should have done something differently. Or blah, blah, blah. If you go through that, you'll drive yourself crazy. I mean, it will take away from what you normally do. And we don't want that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So to dive backwards just a little bit into your past, your background, I guess basically in a short manner of speaking, how did you get started using your voice to make a living?
Radio. I started in radio. I was when I was a kid, I was a radio junkie. Radio's one of the reasons why I'm a musician too. I loved listening to the radio when I was younger.
Where did you grow up? What were you listening to when you were young?
That's an excellent question. I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and I was born and raised there.
Oh, okay.
My first radio gig was there. My first and longest, really, now that I think about it. I was raised in Syracuse, and just one of four children, me and my brothers, driving around in the car with the parents, and AM radio was on, and it was pop music. Back in the day, I mean, you'd hear Olivia Newton-John going into the Bee Gees, and then into a Beatles song or Paul McCartney song, stuff like that. And so I started out, I was a huge fan of radio, and it wasn't until I was probably in my mid-teens that I really started paying attention to the disc jockeys. And then, of course, I wanted to be a disc jockey. And then my earliest memory of wanting to be like someone or sound like someone was listening to those concert commercials on the radio, those Bill Young productions. It was anytime a concert commercial came on, I was like, this guy is the bomb, because he had that voice,
So
Saturday, blah, 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 blah,
like,
blah, blah, blah. He had that really deep, deep, rich voice, and it had the music behind it and the crowd, and they were really good at making people want to go to concerts. I wanted to be a disc jockey initially. Yeah.
You were kind of like the irritating radio person where whenever we're in the car with friends or family or girlfriend or wife, et cetera, we're turning things up when most people would turn them down.
Right.
The commercials, the imaging, that such.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially.
And you were that guy as a teenager.
Oh, yeah. Especially if it was, like some of the stuff that Dick Orkin would do. His radio spots were always very, very creative and crafty. And, that stuff, even before I knew who Dick Organ was, I would hear this, those radio spots. Yeah, I was always kind of drawn to it. You know, I thought it was really kind of a cool thing.
So, obviously, you get a career into radio, and I don't want to go too many. I want to spend more time here on your voiceover career. But and if you can, I mean, unless you don't want to, ballpark the era when you were just getting in. You know, when did you start your actual career, when it became a job?
I started interning at a station that was the classic rock station in Syracuse, WKFM, 104.7 Kix FM. Started interning in the summer of 80. No, actually, maybe it was before the summer. It was 1988. Interned for maybe a year and worked my way up into a crappy, you know, Sunday morning, you know, 4-hour slot where I was playing public service, you know, shows,
sure.
And then maybe, yeah. Maybe flashback, and then I'd get like a half hour of airtime. Started there, eventually went to, eventually became the full-time overnight disc jockey, which I did mysteriously, miraculously for 2 years. Then moved up to evenings, which lasted about a year, and then the station got sold and we all got canned. And so, but I knew by the time I had moved to the evening shift, I already knew within the year, within that year of my of doing evenings, that I knew I wasn't going to want to do this forever, because it's not that I didn't like it. It's just that I kind of saw that there was no particular future in it for me, because I wasn't necessarily an entertaining kind of person. Like I would, there's no way I could ever be like a morning show host, because I'm just, I mean, now on satellite radio, probably good, but I'm a big time potty mouth guy. I'm amazed I haven't dropped an F bomb so far. But I knew I didn't want to be a disc jockey. So, I was actually interviewing for production gigs and finally, got one, after we got canned. Luckily I was only unemployed for like maybe a month or 2 months. Got a job in Binghamton,
okay.
Binghamton, New York, which is about you know, an hour and 15 minutes south of Syracuse. Was there for, how long was I there for? Probably about 9 months. Then got a job in Akron, Ohio at WONE, Akron, Ohio. Heritage. Mm-hmm. Heritage Rock Station. We can say that, right? WONE in Akron.
Yeah.
That didn't last very long. I was hired by Harv Allen, who, when the station was in the process of being of changing hands, some local this guy's name I'm totally blanking on right now. I think it's still there, Rubber City Radio Group. This guy was transitioning, so as soon as he got actual legal control of the station, he like canned Harv immediately, and then also kept pressing me to sign this contract that had a non-compete for Cleveland, because Akron and Cleveland were so close. And I knew I didn't want to sign it, so I sort of just, you know, hemmed and hawed on it. And then 4 months later, I get a job offer from Mitch Todd at WMJI in Cleveland. And so...
Yeah, everything comes back to Mitch lately on my show.
Mitch, yeah. Mitch, so I worked there. I worked with Mitch. Not very long, for probably about 6 months. And I learned a lot from Mitch Todd. Not only creatively, but also engineering-wise. I've always used EQ and certain things to that point, compression, but he definitely helped show me slightly more proper, you know, ways of doing it. So he was great. He was a lot of fun to work with. It was a great, in looking back, even though I was only there for like 6 months, that was probably the best radio job I ever had, because the studios were awesome. We were still tape. We were, you know, most of our stuff was 8-track, 1-inch, you know, produced and mixed on that, and then mixed down to these, like, you know, fantastic, you know, Atari they were like MTR 15 quarter inch decks, whatever, something like that. And we would literally go through like gobs of tape, and we weren't reusing tape, which is all my previous jobs were like, oh, just re-record over it because we're not going to pay for it. And we were like throwing tape out, and Mitch was like, oh, I need to order another, you know, box of pancakes. And I'm like, wait, really? They let you do that? He's like, yeah. And so it was, you know, we spent so much money. It was great. We had all the tools at our disposal. And, you know, as you know, I mean, Mitch is a talented dude. And I learned a lot from him and a great time there. Then my last radio gig was WEBN in Cincinnati. I was there for about two years. Was hired to, I'm not going to say replace because no one can replace him because he's so freaking talented, Eric Chase. Eric Chase was there, and he went to Tampa in 94, and that's when I took over. And Joel Moss, I don't know if anybody's mentioned that name to you before, but Joel Moss.
Yeah, just in the last episode, in fact.
Joel.
But many times, but Deke mentioned Joel, but a lot of this came up just recently with Deke, who was in, anyway, continue.
Oh, Joel Moss is insanely creative, and I learned a lot. I didn't get to use it there, at least. I learned a lot about writing and how it all starts, as he put it, at the typewriter, which back then he was still using a typewriter. But I learned a lot from him. He's crazy talented in terms of just, you know, from a creative standpoint. Just a crazy, crazy, funny, amazing, amazing guy. Amazing, crazy talented. A lot of people there are crazy talented. Jay Gilbert, who was the afternoon jock there for many years. He's a brilliant. So I learned a lot about the written word and how important it is that you start there first. I never really did a lot of imaging. I helped Mitch out with that a little bit, like, you know, at MGI. But I was always doing commercial stuff. Yeah. I was always doing commercial stuff, so I wasn't really much of an imager. I enjoyed it. But and it was at Cincinnati where I got my very first radio station, which I still have to this day, almost 20 years. WCLG.
Which station was that?
WCLG in Morgantown, West Virginia. 100.1 WCLG. Yeah. I still have them. I think that's awesome, personally. That's like kind of cool to say you've been.
It is awesome.
Kind of cool to say you've been on a radio station for almost 20 years. That's pretty cool.
So 20 years coming up next year, probably, or somewhere in that ballpark?
Yeah, I think I got them in, probably 2 years from now. I think I got them in 95, yeah. I think. I got CLG, and I got, like, Shom FM in Montreal, like, around the same time. Those were, like, my first two. And then, I've never had a whole lot of stations. I've always been around, like, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20. So it's, like, it's a good workload for me. I dig it. Especially now.
Yeah.
Especially
so now. At this point, you are kind of branching into the imaging voice side. Obviously, you've always focused on the commercial side. What precipitated your move? Did you go on your own completely? Did you, how did that work out for you?
I left, I'll be honest, and I kind of, in retrospect, 6 months after the fact, I sort of realized I was not a good person when I worked at Cincinnati, because that was when things were really starting to change. That's when you were able to have, I think at that point in time, you could actually own two FMs and two AMs, but then you could like JSA or GSA or whatever, or you like operate whatever other stations you want without ever actually having to own them. So
kind of an LMA.
So like basically, you know, like we were working, I was hired to, you know, to not only to, you know, take care of the commercial end of things, but also, you know, do what Eric did, which was, write commercials for clients who want original productions. And, but as the times were changing, they were firing people, the people that would normally kind of take care of some of the little things, like, you know, dubs that would, you know, like I would give like maybe 5 or 6 dubs to like the night guy that he would do, you know, he would cart those up for the next day. For whatever reason, whether it was financially or just because they were inept, they got, you know, I lost a lot of these people because they just fired them and never replaced them. So now my day, I found it very difficult for me to be creative when I had so much actual like stuff that needed to get carted up and put in the studio. I felt a lot of pressure because of that, because I wasn't expecting it. And I was really caught off guard by it, and I didn't know how to react to it, and so I became, you know, sort of standoffish. It was about I came home one day and told my girlfriend at the time, I was like, you know what, I can't take this anymore. I gotta get out of here. I'm done. And so we formulated a plan where I go in and give, like, you know, eventually notice in a couple weeks. But before that happened, Joel, you know, actually called me in and had a little come to Jesus meeting with me, because they wanted him to tell me that the sales department finds you difficult to work with and blah, 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 blah. And all of which was true, because my reaction to it was just not good. And I realized that about 6 months later. I realized that I could have made that a much better situation than it was. So basically, you know, he was telling me, like, you know, there, you know, if you don't, you know, change your attitude, you're going to be gone. And so I was like, I already knew I was going to quit. So I was like, okay, cool. Thanks for telling me. And, so I left there. That was my last radio gig, and, moved to Miami with the intention of going straight up freelance, voiceovers, everything, commercials, you know, the whole deal. And I realized, you know, after a short period of time that I didn't really know that much about the business. So, and I needed a job. So I found a job at a recording studio called Airwave Recording, who we did a lot of, it was owned by Robert W. Walker, who worked in Miami radio for years and years and years. He's like a legend down there, basically. Even though he lives in LA now. Robert W. Walker was a huge radio dude down there, and he ended up, you know, leaving radio and buying this studio and was doing, for the most part, a lot of retail commercials, radio, TV, but for the most part was screaming car commercials, hard sell auto commercials that were all created by a place called the Ad Team, which is now defunct. But so I started, I worked there, and I learned at least the commercial side of things, you know, voice wise. I learned from the inside out because I was directing voiceover guys and also, sure, and also then producing commercials. So I learned a lot of stuff from there, and learned tons. And I'm still learning tons from Rob, who's, again, just a brilliant person. And after about maybe 3 or 4 years there, I had managed to sort of just get enough freelance work that I just stopped doing that. And I've been freelance since 100% freelance since 2000.
And so you focus nowadays a lot more on the commercial side. I mean, I guess you always have, but you're, you know, some of the people who listen to this know you as the voice of some stations, but, you know, as we've just discussed, what percentage of your work, you know, comes from commercial versus radio imaging versus, industrial work or promo work and that kind of thing? How does your workload break down?
I would say I'm about 55 to 60% commercial, and then, you know, the 40% radio and promo, mm-hmm. radio and promo together. I'll put them together, and then, you know, mm-hmm. Narration and industrials. That's, you know, I mean, like 5%, just off the top of my head.
Are you still down in Miami?
No, I'm not. I saved the number because too many people had it. I'm actually in New York. I moved here almost 10 years ago.
Okay, I thought you were up there.
Yeah.
So are you in New York City then? Or are you right in the, you know, in the city, or?
I lived on the Upper West Side for the first 7 years or so, 8 years, and now moved to Brooklyn 2 years ago. So I am in my apartment in Brooklyn, New York, which, having been a Manhattan snob for so long, I love it out here. Brooklyn is fucking great. I just have a great time. It's wonderful. It's a great apartment. It, you know, I have my my booth / studio in my living mm-hmm. in my living room, basically, because that's the best place to put it.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? So tell me a little bit about that. You obviously, as you said, went on your own full time down there while you were still in Miami, right? And then,
yeah.
And then at some point you moved up.
Yeah, I moved.
What was the workload like down there versus up in the city? You know, did you do it by necessity? Did you just want to move to New York? And did you find that the work just exploded after moving, or is that not something that happened?
Down there, again, mostly commercial stuff. In the work in the market itself was all commercial stuff. A lot of I did some of that screaming car commercial stuff as well, and then I also did whatever. You know, people would call based off my demo and be like, hey, come down and do a Burger King spot or something like that, you know? I knew that I wanted to do national commercial stuff, and New York is the place for that. It's not what it used to be, but New York is the place for that. And so, I studied with someone down there who was my first coach, who was a jingle singer and a voiceover person as well in New York in like the 60s. The late, great Connie Zimmett, who I miss terribly.
Mm-hmm.
She got me, she's the one who broke me out of my radio voice.
Yeah. Pukey radio voice.
You
got to get out of that.
I still had some of that. So she helped me get out of that. She made me, not made me. I mean, she had me take, you know, acting classes, and then I, you know, studied with her for a while. And, I don't have that radio thing anymore, but it's just because the nature of the tone of my voice, I'm definitely pegged more as an announcery type of, you know, voice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to it's hard for me to escape that. There are techniques, you know, that I do to get away from that, and most times, you know, it works. But of course, you know, that's, I think anybody who does commercial work will always falls into that inevitable description on the script, which is non-announcery.
So, out of curiosity, when you're down there in Miami and you're, you know, you're on your own at this point, you're focusing on the commercial side. You have some of your stations, as you mentioned. You know, were you earning a very comfortable living? Did you feel like you were just sort of barely getting by, and then so you needed to make a big change? You know, give us an idea for where you felt, you know, financially at the time. And then we'll discuss the move to New York.
Well, for down there, yes, living comfortably. Did a lot of work. The only negative side to it was just getting the money, because there were a lot of ad agencies down there that would take, you know, you're always chasing money. And it wasn't until I joined a union where that got a little bit easier.
So did you not have an agent down there that would chase your money for you?
No. I was, yeah, it was me, myself, and I.
Okay, and if you wouldn't, permit me to go off on this tangent then. So it's interesting when I hear about, you know, people that are successful without representation. You know, how would you say you were getting the bulk of your work at that point in time? Now, this is quite a few years ago, but, you know, how did you attain new jobs?
In terms of anything, or in terms of commercial, or in terms of radio?
Yeah, I guess talk about commercial mainly.
Radio station stuff. Oh, okay, we'll start with commercial. Commercially, there were a number of avenues down there. There was one guy who used to have this, I'm sure he still has it, Voiceover Miami, it was called. He would put out this big old double, triple, quadruple CD thing every year, and people would pay to, you know, put their demos on it, and it had, you know, demonstration, it had, you know, descriptions. Connie and I and a number of other people who lived down there at the time, we got together and put out our own thing. So it was marketing, and it was back when people really kind of, demos were still ruling the day. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
know, people at people at ad agencies were actually like popping in, you know, CDs and listening to and listening to voices, you know, and be like, nope.
They had a library on the shelf, and they would actually access it. Yeah,
and so that was back when demos were important, and I mean, they're still important. I mean, but they're not used as the way they used to. So that's how it worked. I mean, you had to market yourself. I mean, down there, and I would have assumed that that it would be like that in any, you know, market that doesn't have like a strong union presence, or you know, anybody who works in a small town is, you know, you got to market the crap out of yourself, you know. So that's what I did, so to the best of my ability, even though I'm a crappy marketer.
Interesting to me then is that you're down there, you know, you're living comfortably, but at some point you decided, look, the real work, the national work, the big stuff is up in New York. So you made the leap. Did you, you know, I guess I would assume though, a lot of the work you were doing down there was sort of local, and you would lose a lot of that work by moving up to New York. Is that true?
It depends. Some of it. I was still working for, I was still doing a lot of work for now it's called Zimmerman and Partners, their retail ad agency. I was still working for them when I moved here. I don't work with them that much anymore because they don't like to work with union people. So I can't do much about that. You know?
Did you join the union when you were down there still, or did you join the union when you came to New York?
I initially joined after when I was down there, and then when I moved here. After I booked my first national, that's when I joined SAG. Because at the time, anybody could join AFTRA, but you needed to have a job in order to join SAG.